evening, everybody. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome to our May evening Sunday call-in. Before I get to our topic, I just want to remind everybody, May is Borderline Personality Disorder Awareness Month. The whole entire period of May is time to boost and get recognition and attention and support for personality disorder. And on the website, you can buy a little bracelet to wear and support Borderline Personality Disorder Awareness Month, and also a very attractive and engaging poster that you may want to pick up. And there's other things going on the website, but we'll move on and leave that to everybody to explore. Our focus today is a little bit different, right to the nuts and bolts and keys of understanding borderline personality disorder and other disorders concerned with measurement. And don't know this, measurement is the route to the most frequent citations. If you want to be a widely cited, cited researcher, come up with a measure that people use extensively, and that is progress. If you look at the progress that we're making, it's often related to measures that allow us to show and identify new things. And, of course, one of the tools here, the problem we have on our measurements is we don't have yet very useful laboratory tests that we can send blood or tissue to that come back with diagnostic results, as is the case with most of medicine. And we wind up with questionnaires that are lengthy. And also, if you use them repeatedly, put people through the same set of questions again and again with kind of fatigue. So one of the questions here is how you can shorten that and have more powerful tools and measurements. By the way, David Schaffer, this is in the current issue of the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, is talking about it, advocating for computerized surveys to help diagnose depression and suicide risk in youth. And this is very pertinent. Imagine now we have the capability through the computer with 4, 5, 6 questions, but with a very reliable and sensitive measure of depression. Questions would typically vary from one time to another. So quickly and easily, one can get a good measure of depression and also tap some suicide risk factors. So the possibility of extensive surveying among youth possible, and of course, with computers almost everywhere, and smartphones, tablets, as well as PCs, it's a tool whose time has come, and our speaker is going to illustrate this. By the way, NIH, with $2 million in funding toward the effort, has something called PROMIS, Patient Report Measurement Outcomes, and they have used the same procedures that our speaker tonight is going to talk about to come up with 9 different measures, and they're available to you. You can get a measure very quickly and easily of depression, of your social role functioning, of anxiety, and other things. So you can get a feel through that of how well it works and the vista it offers. So turning to our speaker, it's really a pleasure to have him. An honor because he's one of our rising stars. He and I share a commonality in that we both got our doctorates at the University of Iowa, separated by 32 years. And subsequently, he has moved on to the University of Buffalo, where he has proceeded up the ranks from assistant to associate professor since 2011, has served there as director of the clinical training program, where they do see a number of borderlines, not necessarily the most severe case because they're not set up to that, but that they do see a number. So engagement, that may well be of interest to people tonight. By the way, I want to inject about questions. We already have a number of questions. Send them in quickly and early. It's great help. Don't hesitate. And Geraldine Downey last week was so impressed by the questions and engagements that she's asking to come back for an opportunity to have a real dialogue and interaction with people around these topics. Anyway, Leonard also advanced in the grantmanship world, a 5-year R01 grant from NIH, which is now into its 5 years. And we're talking about a biggie here, $2.5 million over the 5 years. So this, and the competition for this is a real distinction and honor. And he's been recognized elsewhere by the Award for Outstanding Early Career Research, Field of Personality Assessment, which is something he's going to be talking about tonight. And he also has given invited talks around our country, from Texas to Stony Brook in New York, up into Canada and Toronto and Waterloo. He's served on editorial boards for 3 journals, done reviews for 19 others, and, of course, has a whole slug of publications and research journals. And he has very graciously given his time and expertise to NIMH reviews of grant applications. And one last thing I want to mention is we talk about borderline personality disorder as a personality disorder, but very rarely it's kind of like operates separately from personality. And if we're going to really have this as a personality disorder, we need to understand and measure personality and how it interfaces and interacts with the symptoms that are expressed if we're going to really progress along those lines. So with this, let me get out of the way of our distinguished speaker tonight. And Dr. Sims, it's all yours.
Great. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate the introduction, and moreover, I appreciate being invited to participate in this, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about the work we've been doing and also about looking forward to questions I might get about the work and how I might answer those. Anyway, so the talk is really in 2 parts. One is going to be the rationale for the CAPPD project, which is the kind of the little buzz phrase that we've come up with for our project. And the second part will be the CAPPD project itself, what the rationale, the data we've collected, and just a summary of where we're at with that project. And toward the tail end of that, I'll talk more about computerized adaptive testing and how I think that can help move the field of personality disorder research and applied work forward. So I'm on the first slide now. Jim has asked me kindly to make sure I let you know when I'm advancing. So I'm going to advance on to the second slide, DSM-4, DSM-5, definition of personality disorder, which you have listed there. And notably, many of you are probably aware that the DSM-5 group was considering some fairly significant changes to the definition of personality disorder, but at the end of the day, as we'll talk more about through this presentation, the DSM-5, the main part of the PD definition will be essentially the same as what was found in DSM-4, what you have here. DSM defines personality disorder as an enduring pattern of inner experience and behavior that deviates markedly from the expectations of one's culture, is pervasive and inflexible, has an onset in adolescence or early adulthood, stable over time, and leads to some sort of distress or impairment. And aspects of this definition will become things I might call back on as we go through today's presentation. These are the DSM-4 personality disorders. I put these up mainly to make it clear that the work I've been doing is about more than borderline personality disorder. It's about trying to come up with a comprehensive system to underlie all the different manifestations of personality problems that people come to the clinic with. Things I'll note about the DSM-4 system that's going to be the DSM-5 system is that things are separated into 3 clusters. Very little data supports the separation of the PDs into these 3 different clusters. Factor analytic work doesn't bear this out, and other work doesn't bear it out as well. Why do we study personality disorder? This is probably very clear for all you on the call in here, but we know that the prevalence of personality disorder is approximately 10% in the general population, as high as 50% in psychiatric settings. We know that personality disorder is associated with significant impairment. It's increased utilization of healthcare services, increased self-injury, suicidality. We know it's associated with attenuated responses to many treatments, physical and mental health treatments. Thus, assessment and treatment of personality pathology is an important endeavor in both applied and research settings. Okay, I'm turning the slide now to problems with the current system. Okay. This may or may not be well-worn territory on this in this group, but I want to report a few things that lead us to have questions and concerns with the DSM-IV categorical approach. One is that there's excessive comorbidity among the 10 primary PDs that I listed. We know that if you do a thorough diagnosis of individuals using structured interviews, that if a person meets criteria for one personality disorder, on average they'll actually meet criteria for two or three total. Which suggests a good degree of overlap across them is not ideal. People generally have, when you think about it, we really have one personality that's become disordered, not three or four or two. You know, there's really one primary personality disorder per person. In a system that tells you you have two or three of them isn't carving nature at its joints quite well. But a second item, a second problem is within diagnosis heterogeneity. We know that because of the polythetic nature of the diagnostic criteria, there are many ways to meet those diagnostic thresholds. For borderline, for instance, there are over 250 ways you can meet the 5 of 9 criteria that are needed, which is a bit of a challenge in applied and research settings because it leads to the fallacy that two individuals with the same borderline diagnosis, for example, are the same in terms of their features, and that's not at all true. They may be, in fact, completely different because they could share no more than a single criterion in common. Third, we know that the current system has poor coverage of the PD symptomatology that comes to clinic. The number one diagnosis given for personality disorder is personality disorder not otherwise specified, which tells you that the 10 that are listed don't properly or fully account for the full range of personality problems that we see. We know that categorical PD diagnoses are unstable, which is a challenge given our definition of personality disorder suggests that they should be stable just by definition. This is over intervals, short and long-term intervals. We know that the PD diagnoses aren't stable. We know that different measures of personality problems, of presumably the same personality problems, don't often converge with one another at the levels you might expect, and it's particularly poor for certain diagnoses, certain constructs. Finally, we know that the whole idea of a categorical, either you have it or you don't, sort of model for personality pathology doesn't have a lot of support in the literature. Okay, I'm turning slides to proposed DSM-5 definition of PD.
Lynn, I have a question if I can inject.
Sure.
With all this heterogeneity in what we're diagnosing with the borderline, is this a real entity, and what does this mean for treatment outcome studies if the people are so different?
That's an excellent question. That could take me off in a lot of different directions. I personally believe that there is a thing called borderline personality disorder. It is a distinct entity. I think where I differ from some is that I believe that it's better defined as a combination of traits rather than a list of a polythetic set of criteria. If that makes any sense. So, and I'll say something more about that. So, in the current DSM-5 proposal, I wasn't on that work group, but I have the information in front of me. They were proposing to keep borderline personality disorder, but define it by a certain set of traits: emotional lability, anxiousness, depressiveness, separation insecurity, impulsivity, risk taking, and hostility. Now, I'm not sure that proposal was completely supported. I don't think they did enough work to support that proposal entirely, and I think more work's needed. But I'm in favor of an approach like that tries to identify what are the traits that are most specific to borderline personality pathology and try to identify the proper combination of those traits that should be used to identify that diagnostic group. Does that help, Jim?
Okay. Sorry. I was just passing the question on. We've got some others along that line we'll come back to, I think.
Sounds good. So going to the proposed DSM-5 definition of PD, you know, this, I say proposed, underlined there, because As we'll know in a moment, this proposal was not accepted by the American Psychiatric Association for inclusion as the primary model for PDs, and at least not yet. I'll say more about that if I have time. So we know that criterion A is impairment in self or interpersonal functioning. The part that I've been most, impairment piece is very important because personality traits in and of themselves aren't sufficient to diagnose a personality disorder. You really need criterion B, which is personality traits, in the context of impairment, which is criterion A. And then you have a number of other specifiers, C, D, and E, which should look very similar to what you saw in the DSM-IV definition. But this idea of personality traits being the core of PD assessment was not supported by the American Psychiatric Association. At the end of the day, the Board of Trustees voted it down. Interestingly, the PDs in DSM-5 will be essentially identical to what you saw in DSM-4. It's been described to me as almost a copy and paste, which probably isn't particularly fair to personality pathology, given that we've learned a lot about personality pathology in the last 30 years since the current system has essentially started. More research is needed, though, and I think I agree with the board that the more research is needed before we could transition to a completely dimensional system like the one that was proposed. One thing I will say is that the dimensional system that was proposed will be in DSM-5, but it'll just be in Section 3, what they're calling, which is an interesting outcome because you're ultimately going to have in DSM-5 two distinct PD diagnostic systems, one in Section 2, which is where all the other disorders will be diagnosed, and one in Section 3, which is an experimental section for disorders needing more research. Okay. So that's led us back to the drawing board, in a sense. The APA has spoken, and they don't think the dimensional trait system is ready for prime time, so to speak. And so I'll move on to the next slide, two types of dimensional systems. Despite what APA has determined at this point, I think there's a good amount of literature, and I think that they even recognize that the writing is on the wall. We will, at some point, be moving to a dimensional trait system for PDs, whether it be a 5.1, 5.2, or 6.0. At some point, this is coming. What we need to do is decide whether the proposed approach is the way to go or whether there are other approaches that would do better. So if you wanted to dimensionalize axis 2 or the personality pathology, you could do it in one of two ways. You could measure the existing PDs along continua. As opposed to saying 5 of 9 for borderline, you could just list the number of criteria met. This person meets 3, this other person meets 6, so this other person is more borderline than the other person, for example. However, this sort of a method leads to problems with diagnostic overlap, same problems with diagnostic overlap, convergent validity problems. There's still a heterogeneity problem when you look at it this way. That's led many, including the DSM-5 workgroup for personality pathology, to look more at a trait-based system where you look for the traits that are underlying the personality disorders, and I'll refer to that as the trait-dimensional approach. So we'll turn the slide now, and I'm going to show some data to kind of explain why this trait-based approach, I think, makes a lot of sense. So the next slide says SNAP correlations with SIGPD, SIGD4 PD ratings. And you can see across the top are personality disorders, all 10 of them, and across the vertical you see SNAP scales, which is a measure of personality disorder traits. And I've only highlighted the correlations here that are above 30. What you can see, if you look at it this way with the vertical bars, is that each of the personality disorders can be understood as a combination of one or more, in most cases more, SNAP traits, underlying traits. And if you turn the slide, for example, actually, I'll keep it on this slide. If you look at the borderline column, you can see that borderline could be defined in terms of negative temperament, which is like neuroticism, mistrust, aggression, self-harm is the highest correlation, dependency, and impulsivity. And those correlations make some intuitive sense, given the way many of us have come to understand borderline. And you can do this for any of the columns in that table. Now, if you turn to the next slide, it's the exact same data, but the rows have been highlighted instead of the columns. And I do this to make the point that you can understand the comorbidity patterns that we see across personality disorders by looking across any single row. And you can see that these disorders, by and large, share 2, 3, 4, some cases 5 traits in common, and that is probably, most likely, what's driving the huge comorbidity problems that we see in structured diagnostic interviews or personality pathology.
Lynn, okay, so,
Back to question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The question is, what is the SNAP and what is the SIDP-4 PV rate?
Sorry about that. So the SNAP is a dimensional measure of personality pathology published by Leanna Clark back in the early 90s, and she's done a lot of work trying to elaborate those dimensions, and she's been a big proponent of dimensional systems since she developed this measure back in the early 90s. The SIDP is a structured interview of personality disorders, very much like the SCID2. So it tries to get at each of those 10 personality disorders through a structured series of questions.
Okay, then the third thing is we have scale here. These are the personality disorders across with a scale PAR, SCD, SC.
These tables are showing data crossing personality disorders across the horizontal at the top there with the SNAP personality traits along the vertical there. And I've only highlighted the correlations that are above 0.30. And anything, correlations that are closer to 1.0, of course, are very strong correlations. Anything above 30 or 40 in this case would be consider a moderate effect, a moderately strong effect.
Okay. And borderline would be under the BDL?
BDL is borderline. Yes. Sorry for that. Yep.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. So moving on to the next slide, when it says trait dimensional approaches, you'll see that we have 50, this sort of an approach, a trait approach, is based on 50 plus years of evidence from the normal and abnormal personality literatures. And it used to be that those literatures were going along somewhat independently from one another, but in recent years, as I'll talk about in a moment, we can understand the traits, the normal and abnormal personality traits, by a common structural arrangement. The fundamental dimensions underlying the PDs in this model would be personality traits, not criteria, not symptoms per se, but traits that have gone awry that cause impairment. And if we wanted to build personality disorders, formal PDs like borderline or any other PD, we could do so within this system by identifying empirical combinations of traits that describe these diagnostic entities that we've come to know. The final thing I'll say on this slide is that we know from all these years of literature that trait structure is hierarchical. That you can look at, you can do something called factor analysis, which I'll say more about as we go today, to identify the different groupings of traits that tend to go together in terms of having high relations with one another. And we know that trait structure is hierarchical. There are things called the big two, the big three, the big four, all the way up through seven plus traits that you can see across models. And in fact, on the next slide, if you turn to the next slide, you'll see a diagram, which is the hierarchy of higher order personality trait models. And I won't go through this trait by trait. The main point I want to make here is that this diagram here, and I'll say a few things about it, talks about if you extract two factors, three factors, four factors, and so forth down to six factors, what you get when you factor lower order personality traits like the ones I showed you on the SNAP or any number of other measures that I'll talk about shortly. And you can see the big two model, you get something called alpha and beta, which are very broad kind of evaluative factors. But when you go down another level, you see a big three model where you have negative emotionality, disinhibition versus constraint, and then positive emotionality. At the big four level, you see the disinhibition breaks into antagonism versus constraint or disconstraint. If you go down to the five-factor level, you'll see that positive emotionality splits off, and there's an openness factor that comes out of that that some of you might recognize from the big five model. And if you go another level down to the big six level, you see that something called oddity, or sometimes people call it psychoticism, or this is most similar to schizotypal sorts of traits emerge. And again, I don't want to belabor this diagram. I just want to make it clear that we know a lot about the traits that underlie normal and abnormal range personality problems, and they tend to factor into this kind of a scheme here. And I'll say more about that later if we need to. So let's move on to the next slide. So some might be asking, how do these trait dimensional models help? What is the evidence that allows us to move forward with this sort of approach? Well, And so I've listed the same criticisms of the categorical model to the left, and I talked to the right about how the dimensional models might help things if we were to go this way. Comorbidity. We know that we understand comorbidity is not really a problem anymore if you go to a trait dimensional system, because we understand that the disorders overlap due to common traits. And so if we identify a set of reasonably distinct traits and use them empirically to diagnose PDs, then the overlap issue becomes less concerning. Heterogeneity. The heterogeneity we see in the current diagnostic categories kind of goes away when you base things on dimensional scales that are designed from the get-go to be homogeneous, relatively unidimensional is what I mean by that. Third, poor coverage. I mentioned that the number one diagnosis, if you do a thorough diagnosis, PDNOS is the most common PD diagnosis. We know trait systems are much more comprehensive than a flexible trait system would allow us to essentially capture, I won't say any, but virtually any type of personality problem that could show up to the clinic in any combination of traits that could be present. Fourth, poor reliability. These sorts of systems are based on psychometric scales that have strong internal consistency and they show much stronger stabilities than we see with the categorical diagnoses. We know that the validities are much stronger, cleaner patterns of trait covariation, and we also don't make any assumption that there are categorical entities. Now, you could, as I mentioned earlier, use a trait model to build a categorical entity, but it's not a requirement of a trait system that you do that.
Question okay. That came in.
Yeah.
What's an example for this area of clinical work of a dimensional scale, and how would it differ from a non-dimensional scale?
What's an example of that?
Yeah.
Well, in clinical psychology, I mean, this is kind of in some ways, I think it's a poor example, but it's probably the most ubiquitous example. But in clinical psychology, and clinical psychologists do many assessments in their work. One of the most common measures given, in fact, the most common measure given in clinical psychology practice is the MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. And that sort of measure results in a profile of scores, dimensional scores, that the clinicians use to help try to understand their clients and guide treatment and so forth. Okay, and so this sort of so that's the most commonly used dimensional system out there. And you can see why, in fact, it goes so far as to say the MMPI has a series of profiles that are well studied and well known. And these numbers may not mean anything to you, but you could have something called a 2-7 profile or a 4-9 profile or a 2-4-7 profile. And those profiles correspond with empirical data describing people who have those sorts of scale elevations. Okay, and you can imagine, so in some ways it's very much like a dimensional categorical hybrid, very much like what the DSM-5 folks have been proposing. But what they're proposing in DSM-5 and what the kinds of things that I'm in favor of are just the same sort of thing, but 60 years beyond the date that the MMPI was introduced. So modern technology trying to do the same sorts of things that they were doing in 1943. I hope that makes some sense. But I can say more about that later if there's time at the end.
So, okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So let's go on to the next slide that starts with the word but. But which personality traits? You know, if you wanted to go to a trait-dimensional system, what traits would you want to use? And there are many prominent trait-dimensional measures out there. So this, in some ways, this also goes to the question that Jim just read me. The NEO Personality Inventory is one prominent example that's mentioned in the literature. It's based on the normal personality literature, and it's a big five or five-factor model measure. The SNAP, which is the next one, is the one I talked about earlier on that table. Then there's John Livesley's DAP measure, Dimensional Assessment of Personality Pathology. Those are all the three probably most common measures until this past year, probably the three most common measures used in the literature to diagnose or to look at the traits underlying personality problems. And we know a large literature has emerged showing the links between these systems and personality pathology. But none of these systems are comprehensive. They all have things that the others don't have. And as Jim mentioned in his introductory comments, efficiency of measurement's been a big concern. Some of these measures get up to 400 items long, and that becomes kind of unwieldy in most clinical settings these days, also in research settings. So let's turn the slide to other models. So Tom Whitaker and Eric Simonson reviewed the literature on these trade models in the mid-2000s, identified 18 competing trade approaches and organized them into the five-factor model, and identified over 100 possible traits that could be the basis here. The DSM-5 workgroup also came, I'm going to say more about Whitaker and Simonson's model in a moment. The DSM-5 workgroup also worked on this. They started with they started with 37 traits initially, but the final model includes 25 because some of the traits didn't work out in their psychometric analyses. Their measure, which is now available and being highly cited, given Jim's comments in the beginning, is the personality inventory for DSM-5 by Bob Krueger et al. We know that model, though, is incomplete in important ways, and I'll say more about that later. We know that the problems with the things that went into the model probably caused things to be incomplete, and we also know that some of the methods they used, while not poor methods, but some of the methods they elected to use led to an incomplete model at the end of the day, and I think that's part of where my project comes in, I hope. So there's more consensus for the higher order domains that I showed you earlier, the big two, big three, big four, all the way through big six, than there are for the lower order facets. Let me say more about those lower order facets. On the next slide, you'll see a summary of possible lower order dimensions that Whitaker and Simonson identified. And I won't go through all these. They're there for you to look at your leisure later. These are organized by the five-factor model. And you can see many, many, many dimensions that we'd be hard-pressed to argue aren't in some ways relevant to a broad definition of personality problems. But nonetheless, there's over 100 here, and how are we to organize these? How are we there? And there's a good degree of overlap among them. I think you could, just by eyeball, you notice that some of them look very similar to others and some look more distinct. And we really need some study or studies to come around and to identify what is the most comprehensive but integrated set of traits we can identify that's also efficient. So summary so far, categorical models of PD have problems, many of which I would argue are ameliorated by trait systems. DSM-5 is going to include this experimental trait-based PD system, but I think many believe more research is needed on the system before it's ready for prime time. Moreover, many dimensional systems exist. How are we to integrate across them? And no single model or measure includes everything. And many trait measures are long and impractical in research and applied settings. And all this together led to the project that I'm going to talk about now, which is the CAPPD project. So turn your slide to the CAPPD project slide. The primary goals of this project were to develop an integrative and comprehensive model and efficient measure of personality disorder traits. So there's two parts to this, a model and a measure. And I'll talk a little bit about both of those today. Turn the slide and I'll show you a summary of the research plan. We're about 4 years into this at this point, actually a little bit more than that. We have an extension into the next year. We're going to go to 6 years with this project. Early stage of the project was focused on developing the constructs and the items that would go into the measure. The second phase was collecting a good amount of data from community folks and psychiatric patients. Phases 3 and 4, which we're finishing up now, are focused on calibrating the scales and building the software that's going to deliver these scales. And then the final phase, which we're starting over the summer, is going to be a final live testing study with this computerized adaptive measure and another set of psychiatric patients. We'll say more about this as we go on today. So turn the slide now to defining CAPPD traits and items. I just want to summarize here the CAPPD traits and items and where they came from. And this is, I won't do too much comparing and contrasting with the DSM-5 protocol because I don't have enough time to do that, but I could answer some questions about it later if there are some. We started with Whitaker and Simonson's list that I just showed you, and we sorted it rationally. We operationally defined all those definitions and all those traits, and we had those reviewed by international PD experts, 28 of them. We wanted to make sure that we had a comprehensive set there. You know, we didn't make any decisions that were unduly influenced by our own particular biases. This process led to 59 candidate traits that we organized by a five-factor model, or sometimes we call it a Psi-5 model. Most of the items are based on Lewis Goldberg's International Personality Item Pool, the IPIP, and we rationally sorted those items into the domains and traits with 11 trained research assistants. We also wrote a bunch of new items by our team to cover the extreme PD-relevant content that you might expect with these kinds of traits. These are meant to be pathological trait dimensions, So some of the IPIP items weren't severe enough. At the end of the day, I'm summarizing a couple years' work here, but at the end of the day, the initial item pool included almost 2,600 items for the first phase of data collection, about 1,600 of which came from the IPIP, and about 1,000 were new items that we wrote. An average of 44 items were written per candidate trait. You might ask why so many items, and with a computerized adaptive measure, we need scales that have many more items on them than you would expect in a common measure. We would never give anybody all those items, but you need a broad pool that reflects all levels of severity for a CAT to function properly. Okay. Next slide, please. 59 candidate trait dimensions. Again, I won't go through all these for time's sake. You can, again, look at these through your leisure, but these are the 59 candidate traits that came out of the process I just identified, organized in a Sci-5 or five-factor model framework. Turn the slide now to two rounds of data collection. We collected data on all those items in a community sample. Participants were primarily recruited using random digit dialing in the Buffalo area, Buffalo, Niagara metropolitan area. Supplemented, we used random digit dialing and targeted flyers and ads, and we also had to use some university samples to add some lower age group in there where we weren't getting it from the community. The goal of this study was to do factor analyses to hone the initial constructs and to build preliminary scales. We didn't believe we really had 59 traits, but we wanted to err on the side of more than less and let the data tell us when we wanted to combine things. We did some of that, and then we ran a patient study where we used current or recent psychiatric patients who were recruited for mental health clinics all over the community. And we wanted to cross-validate the work from the first phase and hone the scales into final form. For time's sake, I'm not going to say much about this, but because there were so many items, we had to use what's called a planned missing list design, or what's listed here as a balanced and complete block design, to deal with the large numbers of items. No single person could complete 2,600 items. It would be just overwhelming. And so the average person completed about 800 items, which is still very much, but we gave them adequate breaks and allowed them to do that. So if you look at the next slide, it kind of gives you a summary of what the balanced design looks like. And you can see the traits were assigned to blocks, and then blocks were assigned to booklets. And for time's sake, I won't belabor this, but you can see that any single participant just completed a subset of the items. That's the main point I want to make with this. But the analytic strategy that we used allows us to deal with this missing list in a fairly elegant way. So next slide, and I'll show you the characteristics of the community sample. We had almost 1,300 individuals in our community sample, which had reasonable diversity, about 50% female, 50% male, good ethnic diversity, and good diversity in other ways as well. Our patient sample is the next slide. We had 628 patients from the community who we collected. Again, a little more female than male, also very good diversity, although it's more white and black rather than some of the other some other aspects of diversity were less well represented in this particular sample. Let's turn the slide again to structural data and structural data analyses to kind of give you a sense for the kinds of analyses that we did. Now, I'm really summarizing a lot of technical stuff here just to make things accessible and get it in on time. But the block design that I described yielded about 400, a sample size of about 400 and 200 for most of the analyses in the community and the patient samples, respectively. Factor analyses were done iteratively at the item level based on matrices of what are called polychoric correlations. And that's a technical phrase. You don't need to know what that means other than I think it's a better way to handle these kinds of data than the standard correlations that you might see in the literature. Again, most factor analyses were completed within blocks to maximize sample size, and we did some cross-block factor analyses to hone some targeted scales. Again, to get into that would take me another 15 minutes. I don't want to do that right now. But what I want to do today is summarize the scales that came out of this long process that I summarized in three bullet points. And I'm going to do this domain by domain. So I mentioned that we focus on a five-factor model. This is the negative emotionality domain. You can see the initial traits that we started with off to the left there. And you can see in the second column, you see the final CAT-PD scales that came out of it. And then in the final column, you can see how DSM-5 would kind of rationally map onto that. And I do that for a couple reasons. One is to show you that CAT-PD and the proposed DSM-5 are not all that different in many respects. but also to highlight some of the incompleteness that I told you about or that I suggested to you earlier about the DSM-5 approach. So the CAPD, under negative emotionality, we have affective lability, anxiousness, depressiveness, self-harm, submissiveness, relationship insecurity, and health anxiety. Notably, DSM-5 has similar scales, sometimes different names, but the same content, with the notable exceptions of self-harm and health anxiety, and in particular, in the case of self-harm, I consider that a notable limitation of their model. Move the slide to the next one, positive emotionality. You actually see great convergence here between the two systems, anhedonia, exhibitionism, grandiosity, social withdrawal, emotional detachment, and romantic disinterest. Go to the next slide. We have disconstraint or constraint. You'll notice that one of the scales from this domain moved over and combined with affective lability. That's the urgency scale. We also have several scales related to impulsivity, non-premeditation, non-perseverance, risk-taking, perfectionism, irresponsibility, workaholism, and rigidity. And you can see reasonably good convergence with DSM-5, although notably they don't have their light on what we think of as the OCPD scales. Workaholism and rigidity are not represented. They have a rigid perfectionism scale, and that's the only scale they have that would tap things relevant to obsessive-compulsive personality problems. Moving to the next slide, we have antagonism. And this is where I think the DSM-5 approach is most sorely lacking. Our system finds callousness, manipulativeness, domineering, norm violation, which is another way for saying antisocial practices, hostile aggression, anger, and rudeness. In the DSM-5, they have callousness. They only have really three of those domains covered. I consider deceitfulness and manipulativeness to be about the same thing. So they're missing domineering, they're missing norm violation, they're missing anger, and they're missing rudeness, which I think are notable, in most cases, are very notable things that are missing. Finally, the oddity of the schizotypal sorts of traits. You'll find that reasonably good convergence, except that there we have unusual beliefs, unusual experiences. Those are things like kind of subthreshold delusions and hallucinations, but also peculiarity and mistrust. We have scales for cognitive problems and fantasy proneness that are not found in the DSM-5 approach. So turn the slide next to summary of research plan. This is the slide I put up earlier and tell, to kind of give you a sense for where we are now. I could say a lot more about those scales I just told you about. We have lots of data on them, but I want to move on and talk a little bit about computerized adaptive testing. The phase we're in right now is we're kind of finishing up some of the psychometric work that's listed in phase 3 and phase 4, and we're building the software to deliver this measure via the Internet. So at the end of the day, this will be a measure that you could take over the Internet. It'll be available to clinicians and to researchers, and at least for the first 5 years, it's going to be free, which is very nice, I think. And hopefully we can round up enough support down the road to continue to make it free. Okay. Oh, and then the final thing is we're going to finish up with another study at the end, a live testing study. So let's turn to the next slide here, and I want to start talking about computerized adaptive testing. Just to kind of give you a flavor of what that is and what that does for us, in addition to the model that I've already laid out for you. So computerized adaptive testing is a fancy way of saying that we tailor the test to the individual on the fly. A test like this administers only those items that provide optimal information given a person's trait level. The most obvious way to think about this, some of you may or may not know how the graduate record exam, the GRE, has been given, but many ability tests have used CAT for many years now. CAT's not a new thing. It's relatively new in personality testing, but it's not new overall. So in ability testing, like the graduate record exam, the GRE, you imagine you're taking a math test or the math portion of that. It might start with an item of medium difficulty, and if you get an item correct, the next item will be somewhat more difficult. If you get the item incorrect, the next item might be a little more easy, a little less difficult. And the idea is that over time, the test kind of learns about where your ability level is and kind of hones in on your ability level very quickly. Excuse me one moment. I'm going to blow my nose. Okay. So back here. So the test kind of hones in on your trait level or your ability level iteratively by scoring your test after each item response and coming up with an estimated trait level. And I'll say more about that in another slide here. This is built on a strong psychometric foundation of what's called item response theory. It's a fairly elegant theory that I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. It serves as the foundation for the best cash that are out there. These sorts of tests give you marked efficiency over paper and pencil tests, with most cases no cost to measurement precision or validity. An example of this that is in the newer slides that I gave to Jim Breeling, but I think will be posted on the web if you haven't downloaded the newest version, is the Promise Project that Jim mentioned at the beginning. And I've given a URL there where you can actually take a demonstration of a CAT for any number of mental or physical health domains. So the application of CAT in mental health and physical health isn't new either. The Promise Project, there's been a ton of money devoted to that project. And so the CAPED project's really an extension of that kind of work, but in the personality pathology. And we're implementing CAT and the CAPED measure to facilitate more efficient measurement of all traits, and that's currently under development. It should be done by the end of the summer. Was there a question, Jim?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So if you go to the next slide, it'll give you the typical CAT algorithm, and you can see here that a typical CAT will start with an item of median severity. It'll estimate the trait level. So imagine you're taking like an aggression, let's say this is a hostile aggression test that you're taking here. An item of median severity might be something like, I get angry more often than most people. You would answer that item, it would estimate your trait level based on that response, and it would assess some sort of termination rule. If you endorse the item, the next item given might be a more severe item, you know, and it could keep you. Let's say you're a very aggressive person and you're willing to admit it. These items could get very severe. Like I get into a lot of fist fights. I enjoy a good brawl. I enjoy physical violence, that sort of thing. A CAT algorithm will keep cycling through items and estimating trait level and giving new items until some termination rule is present. And usually that termination rule is something like, we want to make sure that your scale score is measured with a reasonable level of precision, which is a fancy way of just saying it's a reliable estimate. Once we know we have a reliable estimate, the scale terminates, and you can move on to another scale or you can be done. So turn over to the next slide to kind of give you a different way of thinking about it in terms of how the item selection might happen. IRC item information curves. So the elegant part of item response theory is that items can be understood by any number of item parameters that tells us how severe those items are or how discriminating those items are. And what you see depicted on this kind of fictional graph here that I laid out for you here are four hypothetical items that provide different levels of information at different levels of an underlying trait. And so on the x-axis, you see the trait level, which is sometimes abbreviated theta. And it's on what we call a z-score metric. So 0 might be an average level, and 1, 2, and 3 would be 1, 2, and 3 standard deviations above or below the mean. And off to the on the vertical, you see information, which is a psychometric construct that tells you how precise an item is at a different level of trait. This is all a fancy way of saying that some items are better suited for people with different levels of the underlying trait. So using the aggression example, if we know someone's fairly high in aggression, let's say the black vertical line that you see there, the first item given might be that yellow item because it gives the most information. And that item might be an item like, I get into a lot of fist fights, true or false, something like that. Meanwhile, if they say no to that and they say no to a bunch of other ones, it might be that their next trait estimate might be down by that red line, which is close to negative one. And the first item administered there might be that blue line, the blue item, which might be something like, I get angry sometimes. And you might endorse that because that's a fairly normative item and it's pretty common for us to endorse. But in a way, I know this is a lot of technical stuff to talk about in such a short presentation, but this is the basis of computerized adaptive testing, and I've kind of given you a flavor for the statistics that underlie a CAT. Okay, turn slides now. IRT, CAT, and personality have been studied together for a number of years. There have been some demonstration projects going back as early as 1989, if you see there. Only Sims and Clark, that's me and Leanna Clark, tested a live personality CAT with the SNAP. So we kind of created a SNAP CAT version of the SNAP back in 2005. But it was only a prototype, and it didn't really result in operational CAT that could be used in clinical or research settings. it's more of a demonstration project. So turn the slide now. And this designates, and what I want to show here on this slide is why we like CAT. Why do we want to use CAT at all? It says CAT time savings. And this goes back to that 2005 paper I just referenced. And what we did is we gave a standard paper and pencil version of the SNAP to college undergraduates, and it took them about 31 minutes to complete. Now, that's fast, it turns out. In the real world, it takes about an hour to complete the SNAP. College students are much faster for a variety of reasons. And so that red bar is 31 minutes about to complete the traditional SNAP. Now, if you just put those items on a computer screen, don't even change them, it's the same exact items, you actually save a third down to 21 minutes just by computerizing the items, which provides a huge amount of efficiency over the standard paper and pencil. But if you do it adaptively in the way I've described in the past few slides, and I hope that was accessible to everybody, you can actually get the same information you got from the 31 minutes, you can get it in about 13 minutes using computerized adaptive technology. Get scores on all the scales, they're reasonably reliable and valid, you don't lose much, and you gain a ton in time and efficiency. So let's move on to the next slide here, and we're at the summary and conclusions. And I could go on for, I chopped out a lot of data just to make sure I could fit in within the time that we have today, but let me summarize and leave a little time for questions. So trait dimensional models of personality disorder, I believe, show clear advantages over DSM-based categorical system. We know that the consensus is emerging on the higher order PD trait domains, but much less with CERN at the lower level, FAFSA level, that Whittaker and Simonson slide that I showed you. We integrated in this study across all prominent trait models and identified 59 candidate traits, and then we honed that to a set of 33 traits, based on the data we collected in community and patient samples. Next slide, more summary and conclusions. We believe that computerized adaptive testing will facilitate very efficient and very flexible measurement. The estimated time of arrival of the CAT-PD measure, at least the beta version of it, is fall 2013, and we're going to use that data for the final validation study that I've described a couple times now. In the interim, we've also developed a static form, essentially a paper and pencil static form, measuring all 33 traits with 212 items. It's a very svelte measure, but all alphas are above 0.80, and there's some other good validities associated as well that I could summarize for folks that over email if people had more questions about this. And I'm happy to share this CAT-PD static form at this point. There's no cost, of course, and I'd love people to start using it in their research if they're so inclined. I believe our final model and measure is in a strong position to inform the structure of personality disorder traits and also future DSM-5-based research. As I noted, we have everything in our model that the DSM-5 model has, and we have some other things as well. Our results suggest that the proposed DSM-5 model is incomplete, and I would argue in some ways in important ways, things like self-harm and antisocial practices like norm violation, things like health anxiety, workaholism, rigidity, domineering, anger, rudeness, cognitive problems, fantasy proneness. These are the kinds of traits that we have in our approach that do not appear for one reason or another in the DSM-5 proposal. So we think our model might help inform future iterations of that model as well. So the next slide, implications for treatment and research. It's likely that future changes to the DSM and the emergence of these elaborated trait models will serve to de-emphasize traditional disorder-specific treatment approaches, perhaps even for things like borderline. Trait-based PD models could and perhaps should lead to treatment plans targeting specific traits or trait profiles or combinations of traits rather than disorders per se, unless those disorders are shown to be empirical combinations of the traits. However, I would argue, or I would admit, that research into these sorts of trait treatment relations is sorely needed. Most of our research is based on these kind of messy categories that we have in the literature now. And the final point I'll make, and Jim Breland knows this better than anybody, and some of you may have been reading about it in the New York Times recently, but cross-cutting transdiagnostic dimension are really the future of funded psychiatric research. And in fact, if you've been reading lately, NIMH's RDoC initiative is in direct opposition to what DSM is doing, which is staying with these categorical disorder entities. And in fact, NIMH has made the clear statement, the leader has made the clear statement in the past week, that funded research at NIMH will no longer be possible for studies that look at only one single diagnostic category to the exclusion of these cross-cutting transdiagnostic dimensions. So with that, I just want to acknowledge all the people who helped with this project, my co-investigators, consultants, my grad students, the other staff that have helped out, the funding source that Jim mentioned that this would have made the work possible, and then tons of research assistants and participants that participated in the work as well. And I just want to thank everybody for listening. And if you're interested in my measure, I've given the my email address there. If you want to know more about it, feel free to shoot me a line there. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you for this really impressive and informative preview of the way forward. It's going to be different and hopefully more functional. As I alerted you to, our listeners have come in with an array of questions, and I've been trying to group them by area.
Okay.
Picking up on, because we won't be able to cover them all, but maybe we can touch upon the major focuses. One has mentioned the New York Times editorial and Tom Insel's, the director of NIMH's criticism of DSM as not having biological base as we would have with other diseases. Do you see any relationships between the personality traits to biological variables and then to also to RDoC constructs? RDoC are tipping to have relevant traits, variables like that have a biological, heavy biological weight.
Right. I think that's an excellent question. I'll touch on a few parts of that. You're foreshadowing a grant application I'm working on right now, and that I really think we do need to look at connections between these elaborated trait systems and the RDoC because, and I'll let me back up for a moment. I think that from my perspective, both the DSM approach and the RDoC approach both have strengths and limitations. One of the limitations of both is that they're both committee, at this point, they're both committee models that aren't based on a ton of data per se. So the DSM approach came about from committees that discussed data, but in many cases didn't collect data to come up with the decisions that they were trying to make. And RDoC, although they talk about it as a biologically based system, really came out of a series of workshops that are committee decisions about what are the domains and what are the cross-cutting dimensions that they believe are important. And without getting into details, if you look at the list of dimensions they've come out with, I would argue that many things are missing, and there's some things there that are very curious, in my view, and that they seem so picayune and so small and so irrelevant to the average patient, if you will, that it's not clear what relevance they'll have in the real world. It's probably, I argue, it's a good start, but I think they need a lot of work. So I think that to get to your question about whether there are, I think there clearly is biological relevance to the traits that are in my system and the DSM system, because we know that the majority of traits like these should have strong heritabilities. And so we know that there's something between the genes and the phenotype that needs to be studied. And I think that studies are needed to draw those connections. What are the things that mediate the genes turning into phenotypes? Is that environmental things? Are there clearly there would be biological things interacting with biological entities? The biology is not my personal strength, but the teams I'm building will have that expertise. But one of the things I'm inclined to do is to start to study elaborated trait systems like the NEO system, R system, the PID, or the DSM-5 proposed system, and study in combination with the traits or the dimensions that are proposed in the RDoC. And that's the basis of a project that we're putting together right now.
It's going to be an exciting project.
If they fund it.
Yes. Several concerns here. When you focus on traits, you're looking at something that's more presumably enduring, more resistant to change. Is this true, and does this imply that we would be looking for more long-term treatments than rather short-term behavioral treatments?
Well, so yes, I suppose the short answer is yes, that we are looking at, when we talk about traits, by definition, we think of them as more enduring. And that's really not all that different from what the assumption has been under the current PDs, frankly. I mean, we assume that these are long-standing, enduring conditions. You know, they may wax and wane somewhat. They might be somewhat episodic, but we think of these as essentially characterological, that have their roots since adolescence by definition. So the trait system isn't really any different from that. And so we are, in many cases, the treatments may in fact be longer term, because to the extent these are long-standing, impairing sorts of traits that have caused people in trouble in multiple areas of their lives. But I can also imagine that, and I didn't have time to elaborate this, that might vary considerably across traits. Just calling something a trait doesn't mean that all traits are created equally. Some traits may be more pernicious, more stubborn, if you will, than others. And some things may lend themselves to more short-term treatment approaches. A good example might be something like perfectionism. So perfectionism is probably something that sticks with you over time, but we know, like from the depression literature, that there are cognitive behavioral methods for helping people deal with things like perfectionistic tendencies that are more short-term and can help people probably more adequately live or function in the context of those perfectionistic traits, if that makes any sense. So I think the data are still out on that. I think that these things do generally operate like traits, but that doesn't mean that they're all equally enduring or equally long-standing.
So we have a literature of kind of enduring or flexibility, if you will.
Right, and I think we need a lot of data on that, yep.
Would there be a hierarchy of approaches to addressing traits, that if you had a set of traits, here are a trait or a type of traits that we'd want to focus on first, that would be more door openers, if you will, to change with other traits?
In terms of, are you thinking like in terms of the treatment?
Yeah. Correct.
Treatment? Well, I think that the traits that usually get people into treatment are those associated with positive and negative affect. So people don't generally present for personality problems. They generally present for other things that might be secondary to personality problems. So the most common things that would probably make you show up in a treatment setting would be problems with negative emotionality or problems with positive emotionality, and we have many good treatments for those anyway. Beyond those sorts of traits that are related to positive, negative emotionality, things like antagonistic traits or traits related to disconstraint or impulsivity are often the things that cause people the most trouble in their interpersonal relationships and their work relations. And those would also be good targets for treatment. The oddity traits, in terms of the treatment side of things, the traits associated with oddity are there largely because we wanted a comprehensive system, and those traits come to us by way of things like schizotypal and other disorders where you have problems with cognition and experience. And it's not as clear that those are as amenable to the kinds of treatments that psychologists give anyway. Certainly psychiatrists and other mental health practitioners can get at those traits as well, but might be of a lower priority perhaps in terms of assessment and treatment, and at least in terms of this trait model. If they're fairly fluid along those kinds of dimensions, maybe you don't even need a trait system like this perhaps to identify them. But if it's more subtle in manifestations of them, like we often see with schizotypal, then a trait system like this is going to be helpful. So I'm not sure if that's helpful or not. I mean, I think that the data determining like which traits are the first line we go to and the second line versus the third line, I think we need more data on that. And perhaps that's the kind of thing that led to the DSM group deciding against letting the trait system in at this point. I think more data are needed.
Do you have a feel for whether a trait system would lead to better understanding by parents of a child with what we now call borderline personality disorder, and similarly that the patients would have a better understanding of their disorder than with a current DSM disorder diagnosis?
My view is yes, that they would, that both in both cases, the parent and the clinician and the patient they'd all have better sense of who they're dealing with, because the system would be more precise. patients in this kind of a system would be identified as essentially the sum total of the traits that they exhibit, rather than necessarily a diagnostic label that has a good amount of heterogeneity in it. As I mentioned, something like borderline, there are over 250 ways to meet those criteria. And so we often operate on the fantasy that individuals with the same diagnostic label are essentially the same. In fact, some patients who have that label may be under the misunderstanding that they're like something that they're not in fact like, because they don't actually exhibit half the criteria that others might exhibit, you know. So I think that a trait system, if it's properly implemented, would presumably allow people to have a much more precise understanding of the kinds of traits or the kinds of problems that they as patients are exhibiting, that their patient, if it's a clinician, that their patients are exhibiting, a parent, that their children are exhibiting. It's these five traits, and if you want to combine them and call them this disorder, then fine, do that. But it's, in my mind, the precision comes from breaking things down to distinct traits rather than heterogeneous, messy categories. That may be an unpopular view among some, but that's my view on it.
Well, it reminds me of the early days of behavior modification analysis, the pinpointing the problems and focusing on them.
Right. It's not different from that, yeah.
Question is, would a trait approach apply to what are now, have been the Axis 1 disorders like depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, so forth?
So the trait approach that was proposed for DSM was mainly to replace the personality disorders, the 10 disorders that I showed you earlier on. having said that, there are people out there, and there's a good amount of research to suggest that the same traits that describe personality pathology can be used to help describe Axis 1 disorders as well, things like depression or anxiety, other things. Now, there's good work by people like Bob Kruger and kind of people doing similar sorts of work that shows that the same five factors that I've talked about here, that hierarchy I showed you, that sci-fi five-factor model, can be used to describe Axis 1 and Axis 2 traits together. So as proposed, this model and the work I'm doing was really geared toward DS or to the personality disorders. Certainly there are individuals thinking about the future whereby you would have dimensional understanding of all disorders that, for which maybe some of these traits would be relevant, but perhaps you need additional traits to help identify some specific Axis 1 disorders that aren't really encompassed yet. You mentioned depression. I personally believe you could diagnose depression based on this trait system, and not only mine, but the DSM approach, the proposed DSM approach. But something like obsessive compulsive disorder, you'd probably need some additional traits, some additional dimensions, if you will, to get at the specific ways in which that manifests separately from other anxiety disorders.
Okay, you've got a converts here.
They
threat-
what?
Converts to your system.
Okay. That's good.
We buy it, but they want to know, ask him how quickly he can get the research to clinicians and train them to use it.
That's an excellent question, and certainly I think I'm a decent researcher, but I've never been a good marketer, but certainly one of the things we're going to be doing over the next year or so is kind of doing a full court press in both the research literatures and also trying to even advertise the measure a little bit on the internet and other ways to let people know that this all exists, you know. And so I'll be trying to draw on the expertise of people who are better at that sort of thing than I am. But in my view, the only good system is one that's used. And so I'm not a big ivory tower guy. I don't want this work just to sit in my office in my lab and go on that way. I really want this to be a system that people use, and I'll be interested in advice. And if there's people interested who are practitioners out there in this, I'd be happy if they send me emails with either ideas or requests for the information that we have so far on the model and the measure.
I can't speak for the National Educational Alliance, but I think there would be interest in helping to disseminate this effort and get it used. Anything that advances our diagnostic scheme and our understanding and in turn leads to more focused and effective treatment is a real plus. So we've gone over our time because of the high interest, and thank you for taking your Sunday evening and hanging with us beyond 9 o'clock to respond to some of the questions. You've stirred a nest of
interest here. And,
great.
I won't even touch the other questions. They were good. but maybe we can have another discussion session later next year sometime if you would be available.
I'd be happy to come back.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, both of you.
Good evening, everybody. Have a great week. We will talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.